Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Asia Business First podcast. I'm Adam Bhaktia.
And I'm Julie Yu.
Julie, it's so good to have you back. You've been gone for far too long. I think you've missed the last two podcasts, and everybody's missed you. You were in the UK for a holiday. That must have been nice. Weather was good. What did you get up to?
Yeah, weather was fantastic. And I even had a chance to visit different cities, including Oxford. And one thing I noticed was this large number of cyclists on the road. And I guess it's not too surprising given that it's a university town. Mm. But what was surprising was the number of bikes I saw on the road that are from bike sharing firm OFO. And I found out that Oxford was actually one of the latest cities to begin allowing OFO to operate there. Did you know this?
Well, it's a great way to get around, isn't it? Providing the weather's good, because you know what the weather's like in England, right? It can be dreadful in winter when it's raining all the time and cold. But, you know, speaking of cycling, the business of bicycle sharing has been making the headlines here in Singapore all week long, and whilst you were away as well. Three bike sharing companies in Singapore have closed down. Among them, the first one to start operations here, called O-Bike. Now, at the time of this recording, O-Bike is holding on to about 6.3 million Singapore dollars in deposits, and many users are concerned about whether they're going to get their money back.
That's right. I guess the writing was on the wall for O-Bike because about 2 weeks before their announcement, it also left the Melbourne market because of tough new regulations, which would have allowed the city to fine the company $3,000 per bicycle when it failed to collect their dumped or damaged bikes.
Yeah, well, as for Singapore operations, O-Bike decided to close down here before a new licensing regime kicks in fact, on the 7th of July. Besides having to apply for a license from Singapore's Transport Authority, operators will have to regulate their fleet sizes, pay a registration fee for each bicycle, and ensure that the bicycles are parked in designated areas. They will also have to keep track of users who park indiscriminately and ban recalcitrant users. And Julie, we both know we've seen many of those.
Yeah, I've seen some disturbing pictures on social media of all weird ways these bicycles have been mistreated. You know, they're parked in bizarre places. We were just talking earlier about what happened in Melbourne, where authorities, they fished out 40 bikes. Some were even found hanging on the top of the lamppost, on top of the trees. I don't know. Were they running away from something? This is just ridiculous, really. But
maybe,
as you can imagine,
it was a prank. Who would throw bicycles in the road? I mean, that's just ridiculous. But anyway, you know, even without the regulations, how viable is the business of bike sharing in the first place? Let's find out from the experts who are joining us on the podcast today. Pleased to have Nitin Pangaka, who's the Associate Professor in the Department of Strategy and Policy at the NUS Business School, and Pradeep Varakantham, who's the Associate Professor at the Singapore Management University School of Information Systems, who has studied bike sharing systems for more than 4 years. Welcome, gentlemen, to the podcast. Good to have you both. So, Nitin, let's start with you, because in your commentary on our website, channelnewsasia.com, you said that you were one of those inflicted customers that did not get his deposit back. Clearly, you must have been quite surprised at this announcement. I hope it wasn't a lot of money, by the way.
It was. Actually, my son was the user, and I just... he went off to Canada to study, and I was procrastinated on asking for the deposit back. Though in the past, you would see them collecting the bikes periodically, and this time there was a good pileup for a couple of weeks, and I should have seen the signs that there's something amiss, but I didn't. And it's $49. I hope to get it back, but if it is not, that's what it is. Yeah.
So it's not a deal breaker for you.
No, it is not. Luckily not. Yeah.
How about you, Pradeep? I mean, I know that bike sharing is still a very novel concept here in Singapore, but were you surprised by the news?
Actually not. I had heard of the regulations and heard that they were quite strict. I was talking with some other company as well, one of the bike sharing companies, and they mentioned that they were quite strict and they were having a lot of discussions with LTA on reducing the regulations. So it was, I wasn't expecting that they would leave, because I personally believe that it's a good business model. It has a good segment.
Well, in the beginning.
Yeah. So I was a bit surprised that, because they started with a decent number. I heard it was about 14,000 or so bikes. So it's a good enough number. So I thought they would have had the investment and so on to do this properly. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the regulations here are too steep in comparison to other geographical places that these companies operate in? And we, of course, know Singapore's very pristine and clean and organized, and there are many laws and regulations to keep the city as such. So is it unusual, the regulations here compared to
actually other places? I don't know the regulations outside, so I can't comment in comparison. But to be fair, the government gave almost 1 year free ride for these companies to, I mean, they signed an MOU, but there wasn't much done on the indiscriminate parking and so on. So I think they jump maybe from one extreme to another extreme, but you don't know the details, I guess, how strict they are, on what basis the regulations were put. So it's hard to argue without seeing the actual numbers there. But hearing from the bike sharing side, they seem to say that they're quite strict. Mm. Yeah.
Because O-Bike isn't the only dockless bike that are actually pulling their operations overseas, right? Mobike withdrew from Manchester. Gobi Bike, I believe, is out of Paris. And what do you read into that, Nathan?
Actually, the fleets that these guys put in Singapore were ridiculous. Actually, they are, I think, Mobike or Ofo, one of them is saying they have 80,000 bikes. And when you multiply that by the licensing fee, it's going to be a huge amount. And I think in the first part of the operations, like the beginning of the operations, probably there's very little concern about profits. So you just put 70,000 bikes or 80,000 bikes without worrying about what is the utilization rate of that, of those bikes. And when you put a much bigger than optimal fleet, the chances of vandalism go up as well, because you know, the bike is just lying there. You allow the people to park it anywhere, right? And when it is like not in the public eye, it's much more likely to get vandalized.
Well, it seems to have changed the game, right? If you look at what's happened to O-Bike and the $6+ million in deposits that's stuck, you know, competitors like Mobike are saying that they're going to be waiving these deposits now. But I mean, when you start down that path, that road, you're completely changing in a way the business model, because I mean, as many analysts say, that that's where the real money is. I mean, is that going to be a good move if we start to see this competition where the other competitors say, okay, you're not going to waive the deposits? What is that going to be into the for the viability of these bicycle sharing companies?
I think this is a long-term model. It's a long-term business model. They have to be invested in it for a decent enough time, because they're bringing in these big fleets. And it's a segment where the amounts that you get per ride is a small amount. So it takes time, because the maintenance comparatively is lower. So as they go along, the cost they have to incur is lower, and they keep getting on the money, because these bikes aren't that expensive. So I think they have to be invested so that they're able to deal with all the fines, all the regulations and so on. They bring in it and wait for a certain amount of time before I think they start making profits.
I think down the road, maybe let's say another company goes under, I think the government is going to probably require them to remove the deposits anyway. Okay? Because if more people lose the money in their deposits, the government is going to step in and say, you can't take the deposits. I think the key point in deposits is they ensure that you can recover some of the money from the buyers, right? The renters. But I suppose if you strike a deal with a credit card company, which is where, you know, because you're charging the credit card, right? When somebody rents the bike, that if there is damage to the bike, you can recover that. But that's not an easy agreement to sign, because there's going to be lots of dispute on that. You know, the user will call the credit card company, say, I did not damage the bike and so on. But that's probably the agreement that they would have to make in the long run, because I think the deposits model may become sort of unviable from a regulation or a popularity point of view.
So do you think there could be, you know, decent profits to be made if the market sort of consolidates, perhaps a merger between, you know, Ofo or Mobike, and or when these weaker companies sort of, you know, drop out of the race?
I think there is money to be made, provided you figure out what your costs are going to be. So provided you come out with a much smaller fleet, provided you factor in the cost of penalties and so on. And then you charge appropriately. You know, today, you know, I've been sort of flamed online for saying this, but some of the some of the prices are ridiculously low, you know, and they won't allow you to make money. So you have to build in all these costs into the equation and then find out what is the optimal price to be charged. And
but isn't that the standard strategy for these new world technology companies? It happened with ride hailing as well. I mean, you just drop the prices to get market share, right? I mean, it's no different, is it?
And I think, yeah, there are two kinds of business models. You can either start bottom up, start with small fleets and then try to slowly consolidate the market, or what these companies have done, which is drop everything they have and then try to figure out where the demand is, consolidate the demand as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And just adding on to the previous point, I think the consolidation in this market will not be like Grab taking over Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Here, really? It may be that, okay, I have my area set. I know this is the area where I have seen demand come in. So I will focus on this area. You guys go take these other areas. That could be a kind of consolidation that could happen where each company figures out certain areas where they are good at or where they have knowledge that people are taking bikes. So it is possible. I think that's what it will eventually lead to, given the strong regulations.
Pradeep, that sounds like collusion in a cartel.
Yeah. Mafia.
Yeah. I think if individually they are unable to, unable to deal with the regulations, right? It's best to be consolidating in place where they know where the demand is. Mm-hmm. And it's a agreement. It's a negotiation, I guess, between the companies, not so much a collusion.
Actually, the money-losing business model, which is, you know, pricing below cost, is sustainable only if somebody is willing to fund your losses.
Mm-hmm.
And it works if the market share is sticky, you know, which is once people sign up with you, they are going to... I'm not sure that there is any stickiness in any of these services.
Mm.
So why was Grab charging low prices, or it is not charging low prices anymore, but why was it? Because the VCs were willing to kind of fund its losses, right?
Mm.
And at some point, the VC is going to say, okay, forget it, you need to make money. And the moment that happens, the prices will revert to the... But I think the other thing that I'm skeptical of, and maybe Pradeep can talk a little bit more about that, is that, you know, I spoke to one of the startups. I won't talk much more about it because then you may be able to guess who it is. So they said, oh, we are collecting this data. I spoke to a middle-level manager, which doesn't mean much because it's a small company. So anyway, so he said, oh, we are collecting this data and we are going to sell this data. I said, what is the value of your data? So he had absolutely no clue. Mm. I said, who is going to buy this data? So for this data collection, if you're pricing below cost, that makes zero sense. Because I have no idea what the worth of that data is. I suspect the worth of that data is going to be very, very little. So the fact that I rented a bike from my home to go to a hawker center,
right,
I think is worthless.
Right.
Or it is... 0.00000 some cents. You know, that doesn't mean that you can lose money for the sake of collecting the data.
On that point of data, in the case of O-Bike, according to the regulations, is there value to the data that they've collected if they're going to cease operations?
I agree with Nitin that it's not as valuable. Maybe for a bit of urban planning that, we know that people keep moving between these locations and they're willing to take, I don't know, ride for a kilometer. So maybe we put a biking lane to some other location which is within 1 kilometer. But other than that, I don't see much value to the data. But I'm sure LTA and others are figuring out ways of getting that back and making sure they can use it. Yeah.
They could sell the data in aggregate, probably. They could allow somebody to derive some insights, but they can't sell individual data, I think. You can process the data, right? You can process the data about, you know, so which are the frequently traveled paths and so on and so forth, at what time of the day and so on. But the data is much more, I think, for optimizing your own operations rather than revenue generation. But a lot of people are just saying, oh, we'll collect this data. It's so valuable. I'm not so convinced that data is so valuable.
But couldn't it help with, you know, mitigating these parking problems, for example?
Exactly. No, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, yeah, but again, it's for their own individual operations, right? Mm. Not so much for anyone else. Oh. It's for their own operations to increase their profits.
It's not for revenue generation. You can optimize your operations. So if you know that from this point at 5 p.m., there are a lot of people who rent the bikes, then you supply more bikes at that point at 5 p.m., which helps you a little bit. But it's not as if, you can sell the data to an advertiser and the advertiser is willing to pay big money for it. I doubt it.
You know, in the fallout of O-Bike, and whether we see consolidation or not, or as Pradeep, you suggested that it's divide and conquer, into various geographical regions, whatever the case is, they seem to be burning through so much cash because Ofo Mobike is said to burn through roughly $25 to $50 million a month. And those two are backed by tech behemoths. I mean, we're not just talking VC, we're talking tech behemoths, Tencent and Alibaba. That brings up the question of the viability of the business model. And in the end of the day, what do you think is the ultimate aim of these companies, you know, if they're never really going to make a profit?
I think that they are trying to capture that first and last mile segment between houses to MRT stations or offices to MRT stations, that segment. And that segment can be quite big if people are continuously taking that and there are enough biking lanes that are put in place. I think that that's a reasonable size segment. But again, the numbers, if they match up to those numbers, it's not clear. But yeah, definitely. I mean, they are pumping in huge amounts of money. I heard Ofo has like $1 billion, but that's probably over all international operations or so.
Yeah, I hear this. So there are about 5 out of 8 bike sharing firms that are still operating in Singapore. So how can they, make this work? How's it possible to keep the cost down when, you know, bikes have to be rounded up, manually, when they have to be redeployed to places where, you know, usage is high?
I think the fleet has to go down. There is no question about that. Because if you have to pay per bike, I remember reading that these guys have minimized the cost of the bike itself, which is like $50 or something with all that, you know, technology in it, because of the large scale that they're buying. Mm. But then if you pay $50 or $60 for licensing, right, it doubles the cost of the bike, right? Mm-hmm. And $50-$60 into $80,000 is going to mean a lot of money. Mm. I think they have to rationalize the fleets. They have to manage the penalties, you know, they have to minimize the penalties. So actually the data would come in useful if you can reduce the penalties in terms of indiscriminate parking and all that stuff, you know. The business model has to be fine-tuned much more going forward for it to make money. It can't make money in the present form.
I know for a fact that Ofo has already commercialized, meaning earlier they were giving all these passes, which would be like $7 for 30 days, something like that. But now they charge per ride. Mm. And I think after the regulations came in, they are already being put under the pump to show the viability of the business. So I think at some point, the big companies will also not just allow for the free flow. I think that has been there for about a year or so. So
another big problem, I think, is I just mentioned it earlier in our intro. We talked about it, Adam and I, you know, how the bikes are being mistreated and vandalized in so many different and creative ways. How can this problem of, you know, poor consumer behavior be tackled?
I mean, the one thing I know is they are introducing this QR code so that every bike has to be placed back within those yellow boxes. Mm-hmm. But I am not completely sure that this kind of behavior, if it's really a lot of people or it's just a few outliers here and there who are doing really naughty things. I don't know.
There are companies that actually pulled out because almost 90% of their bikes were stolen. In Europe.
Yeah, okay.
Europe makes sense.
I think if you reduce the fleet, I think it's automatically going to take care of some of the issue. Because right now, if you need, let's say, a fleet of 10,000, right? Mm-hmm. And you have 70,000, that means 6 out of 7 bikes are lying idle. And lying idle is the kind of invitation for people to do vandalism and all that. Mm-hmm. But when the bike is kind of continuously being used, not continuously, but frequently being used, the chance of, because the moment you park it, somebody else might, in a few minutes, somebody else might come in and take it and ride somewhere else. So that, I think that reduces the chances of that.
Getting back to the viability of the business models, I mean, does it really matter, I should say, whether they're actually going to make a profit? Because if you look at the development of internet-enabled companies, you know, over the last, perhaps, let's say, before a decade, I mean, Amazon for years didn't make money. Let's face it, neither did Netflix, right? Uber doesn't make profits. I mean, it does make a big amounts of revenues. And so does it really matter whether bicycle sharing companies are not making profits when a great deal of these internet-enabled companies have made huge headways in the global capital markets and the economies by, you know, making, because they've been empowering forces on our lifestyles today. And eventually, perhaps they just get taken out by buyers. I mean, is that what investors look towards when they are, you know, scrutinizing investments in this space? What do you think?
I still think it's viable, but again, it's a long-term investment. Like with Grab and so on, they just started making profits once they were the only player in town. In the same way, once they have consolidated, they have the right fleet sizes with the corresponding demand, I think they will start making money, because if they are in it for the long term, if it's just they want to put everything in place, have the right apps, and then they want to get out, I don't think they will make money in the really short term. It has to be a long term. Right. And I think it's connected with the previous point, in the sense that once the biking culture kicks in, like in Netherlands and places, other places in Europe, where people use on a daily basis, they just use the bikes for almost 2-3 kilometers, or even maybe more. Once that kicks in and there are biking lanes all over the city, it's the amount of demand that is coming in also changes. So over time, I think there's still potential, at least in this space, by sharing the first and last mile.
Nitin, do you think that this is going to discourage investors out there as well? Like when they're looking at these situations, saying, oh gosh, you know, I could have been in a VC in that and I lost all my money. Do you think that these sort of things will discourage people when other huge internet-enabled companies don't make profits?
It's a couple of points. You know, building on Pradeep's point, actually, you know, a strong bike culture is not good for bike-sharing companies, okay? The reason is simple. If you ride a bike every day, you wouldn't rent it. You would buy your bike.
Sure.
Okay? Is the occasional rent, it is the occasional usage or medium usage that is favorable. Because if I rent a bike every day, my costs go up. Instead of that, I might as well buy a bike. If it is predictable. The beauty of bike sharing is you can go from any place to any place, right? So you can get off the MRT at a place that is far away from your home and then rent a bike and so on. Coming back to the issue of money losing, I think we'll use these examples, you know, too casually. So Amazon is kind of the exception and Netflix are the exception. But Netflix has a subscription model. You know, Amazon also is moving to a subscription model. So you have to have a subscription model where people pay you regardless of whether that is a decent model where you can make money, because I think most people don't use it to the fullest. They just pay you per month, like Netflix. You know, most people are light users, the heavy users kind of are few and so on. Google is a completely different story. Google made money, but Google's costs are so low. You know, it costs nothing to show an ad. And whatever you get from that ad is pure profits, almost they do incur. I think a lot of these VCs are just funding this these ventures, partly because they don't want to be left behind. Like Tencent and Alibaba, there is a close race. So whatever Alibaba does, Tencent doesn't want to be left behind. But at some point, there is going to be some rationalization. We don't even know whether these are the same players who will succeed in the long run. But I think they won't get the same long rope that Amazon did. To its credit, Amazon expanded very rapidly. You know, you started selling books, then you got into music, and then you got into everything. So that expansion kept promising investors that, you know, there is a better and better future. So can bike sharing companies do similar? I'm not sure. Same about Netflix. They have expanded very rapidly into own content generation and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, changing the business model, disrupting, that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, we've got to leave it there today. Thank you very much for coming in to talk about bike sharing and here in Singapore and the fate of, you know, O-Bike deciding to cease operations there. So that was Nitin Pangakar, the Associate Professor in the Department of Strategy and Policy at the NUS Business School. And thank you, Pradeep Varakantham, who is the Associate Professor at the Singapore Management University School of Information Systems, weighing in today. Thank you.
If you like this podcast, please share, rate, and subscribe to it for comprehensive coverage of business and political news. Catch Adam and I on Asia Business First Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. Singapore, Hong Kong time on Channel News Asia. It's also available under the video on demand section on channelnewsasia.com.
Right. Thanks for listening. Bye.